It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours. Like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more. Made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
Okay, we are live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a very special guest. His name is Morgan Lerette. His last name is spelled L-E-R-E-T-T-E. And he just published an excellent book in February 2024, full title. And if you're watching this on YouTube or X or Rockfin, is Guns, Girls, and Greed, I Was a Blackwater Mercenary in Iraq. And on Amazon in the U.S. right now, it has 29.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
5-star reviews, and I actually listened to this in audiobook. It's a really good audiobook. It's narrated by Jay Mohr, M-O-H-R. Maybe that name sounds familiar. He's a comedian, and I think he was in a couple movies. But he also has a Kindle and a hardcover, but this is a first-person account.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Of what happened in Iraq from somebody who was literally a mercenary, and a pretty interesting story, and it might be a little graphic too, so I would recommend maybe this is, maybe not have somebody who's under 18 in the background while we discuss this book. So, Morgan Lerette, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's funny, I had a buddy buy the book, and he loaned it out to somebody that he teaches with. And her son got a hold of it and started doing a book report on it. She got called to the principal at her own school. So, yeah, don't the fourth grader is a little too young, but if you know anybody that served in the military, they'll get the book. It's
right. And this is a different form of kind of military action, right? This is a Blackwater. You were involved in that. Maybe you can talk about your background, what led up to your involvement with Blackwater, and then how you made it to Iraq.
Yeah, so I joined the Air National Guard in 1999, before all the wars kicked off. Seemed like the way to get out of small town USA. And then I was just kind of piddling around doing some college, and September 11th hit and my pager went off. That's how old I am, my pager. And they called me up and said, hey, get down here. The US is under attack. So I spent about 2 years on active duty after that. Went to Oman, went to Pakistan, Jordan, Kuwait, and then Iraq during the ground offensive in 2003. So the cool thing about the National Guard is it brings in everybody from every walk of life. So we brought in these former Force Recon Marines, like special operations guys, and I was deployed with them. And once we got home and actually got off orders, they said, hey, I'm going to go work for Blackwater. This was, you know, Iraq 2004. Fallujah had just happened, where the four Blackwater contractors got hanged off the bridge. And I was like, oh, man, good luck over there. That sounds sounds crazy. And he's like, yeah, you should come. And I was like, dude, there's no way. First off, I'm not cool enough. And second off, like, they just had four people hanged off a bridge. So he went to go work for Blackwater and apparently gave my name to one of the recruiters and said, call Morgan. So I got a call at 4 a.m. Because they were on the East Coast and I was on the West Coast. And they said, hey, why don't you come work for Blackwater? And I said, well, I'm an Air Force guy. And they said, ah, that's all right. Your buddy said you were good. So they said, you know, come out here. We're going to train for 2.5-3 weeks. And after that, once your clearance goes through, we'll send you over into Iraq and you'll be protecting diplomats running all around the red zone. So that's how I got in. I mean, I wish I could say I had this big grand plan, but it's just word of mouth and somebody calling somebody that called somebody that called me.
Gotcha. And so you kind of went in after the invasion with Blackwater. That's Eric Prince, right? What was it like kind of joining Blackwater, and what was the, you had some very interesting comrades or fellow Blackwater employees, right?
Oh, geez. Yeah. So, you know, when we're going through training, they told us we're going to have all these armored vehicles and don't worry about it. And we got the mission all figured out. None of that was true. It was really just a bunch of younger guys that most of them didn't even have combat experience, right? Most of these guys were former special operations. They were in the 90s, and they never got to go to war. So this was their chance to go to war. And it is a mishmash of just the craziest, funniest guys on the planet trying to figure out how do you do a job where somebody comes up and says, hey, I need to go over there. There's no GPS. All you have is maps. The maps don't tell you which roads are closed or not, right? You could be driving down a road and there's a big barrier in the middle of it. So we just kind of learned on the fly. Now, the people there, though, I'm probably the most intelligent people I've ever worked with. And I went to Tufts, and I'm not even bragging about Tufts because those guys weren't nearly as intelligent as the former special operations guys. But the stories they would tell and the way that we just partied at the pool while the military guys sat there and watched was such a crazy, crazy time that I finally was like, I got to write a book about the ground perspective of being Blackwater. Eric Prince has his book. Jeremy Skakel has his book. They all have an agenda. I got no agenda. I just want to tell the good, the bad, the ugly, and the hilarious. And that's kind of how the book came about. Just funny stories pieced together.
Right. Like, I mean, you just had character after character after character, from pilots to comrades. And somebody, like you call the guy who drove you in, was like a geriatric or something. It's almost kind of like a frat take on that event. And I think the title reflects that. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah. So when we landed, this is what they don't tell you when you're training. When we started landing, it was this Blackwater plane called a CASA. It's the same type of plane they use for skydiving. So we get up to elevation and I'm kind of expecting the plane to land like a normal plane does, but that's not how Blackwater does it. So they go all the way up to elevation and they start corkscrewing down. So essentially just going in like a circle until they get close enough to the ground that they level off. And they didn't tell us when they were actually going to start diving. So I had my laptop on my lap. I didn't have my seatbelt on. The laptop flies up. I'm like hanging on for dear life thinking I'm dead. And they finally level off. And this guy just casually walks to the back of the plane where the cargo ramp is, sits on the back, and just like sits there swinging his feet like he's on a swing, like he's a third grader on a swing. And I was like, what in the heck did I get myself into? And then they didn't, all the armored Suburbans that they promised us didn't show up at the airport to pick us up. They had these regular Peugeots, which are like a crappy SUV. It's not even like a Jeep. It's kind of like a Kia. And they said, okay, we're just going to drive down the most bombed route in Iraq. Here's some old body armor that smells like somebody else's sweat and body. Here's an M4. Here's one magazine. If anything happens, we're just going to drive as fast as we can. And it's like, what in the hell did I get myself into? Funny, like 2 weeks later, I was the guy going and picking people up, and I was like, oh yeah, I remember what those guys are going through. Like, they're scared shitless. And here I am, like the salty veteran. It's crazy how quickly the transition happened.
And I mean, you're really going into a foreign country. I mean, you talk about living amongst the Iraqi people. You're in Saddam Hussein's, what was his palace or something like that. And can you kind of describe what it was like adapting to Iraq?
Well, so what the U.S. did is we created all these bases. So the Green Zone is probably the largest of the bases, and it was supposed to be this utopian landscape where the Iraqi people lived amongst the military and the diplomats lived in Saddam's palace, which I'll take like 5 seconds to explain this. The nicest place you've ever seen in your life. Every five-star resort probably doesn't even hold a candle to this thing. So we're living behind this opulent, you know, mansion that you only see in New England with the Rockefellers. And even the palace itself was all like broken up into like little sects, right? So military had a part, State Department, CIA. So what you had was a mishmash of bases within a base, and then within those bases you had smaller little cells, and nobody talked to anybody else. And the one people that didn't have a vote were really the Iraqi people. I don't know why we decided that we were going to have the Green Zone and have the locals living amongst us. We did have our restaurant. There was a restaurant that got blown up by an IED. 2 days prior to that, we found an IED in it. It's really a recipe for disaster that nobody, you could tell nobody had planned for this war. We just kind of kept throwing resources at it as we went.
Right. It's really interesting that, and Hussein was still alive when you arrived there, right? I think he had been captured. Is that correct?
Yeah. So he had been captured, was over at the airport compound. And then we had all the high value individuals. So if you remember that deck of cards,
yes.
All those guys were at JSS Justice, which is north of Baghdad, right by Sadr City. So the first team I was on was the team that collected the evidence for Saddam Hussein and Kemal Ali and all those, you know, deck of card guys for their trials. So we would drive evidence up to JSS Justice. We would drive it to courts. We went up to Kurdistan to collect evidence against Saddam Hussein. And then it turns out that that's where Saddam Hussein was hanged. And the funny part is that You walk up the gallows, right? They're really short steps because you have to be able to walk up when your feet are handcuffed. And you get to the top of it, they pull a lever, and that's where the door swings down, and that's where they hanged everybody. Well, on the bottom of it, they realized that when that door swung, it would hit the bottom of the gallows, and then everybody in Sadr City would get all pissed off and start shooting and attacking and stuff. So what they did to fix it is they just glued a mattress to the bottom of it so that when they hanged people, you wouldn't hear it as much because that mattress wouldn't allow that metal on metal to reverberate throughout all of Baghdad. I mean, it's innovation, right?
Right. Wow. And what is it like? I mean, you're basically in a pervasive environment of threat, right? IEDs, locals. Can you kind of talk about what it was like adapting to that day to day?
Yeah, so it's really hard because you're not military. We didn't have the Uniform Code of Military Justice. We didn't have the rules of engagement that were lined out, literally line by line, the way that the military does. We were civilians in a combat zone, not under the military jurisdiction, not under the jurisdiction of the local government, pseudo under the jurisdiction of the U.S. government, but nobody really knew what those rules were. So they told us that we were all essentially diplomats and we had diplomatic immunity, and if something happened, they'd get us out of country. So as we're driving around, we had to make split second decisions on what to do and how to act and react. So to put it in perspective, 04, 05, every car was a car bomb as far as the U.S. military was concerned. If a car is barreling up on us at 40, 50, 60 miles an hour, what do you do when you have the ambassador to Iraq in the convoy? Well, you open your door and you shoot at the car. You hope the car stops. And it's these split second decisions that are so morally ambiguous that you have to give it to the guys at Blackwater that have to make these and be able to go home and sleep at night. Right. That's really kind of the rules of engagement. If I do something where I feel like I can put my head on my pillow, I probably did the right thing that day.
Gotcha. So you're making rules on the fly, and you kind of talk about the difference between you and the military. Can you describe, I mean, was there tension? Did you guys get along? Were you seen as different? And did the natives see you as different, or did they just assume you were part of the larger American military?
All of that is accurate. So the military and private contractors did not get along very well, and we didn't coordinate. So, of course, we would be driving up on a U.S. military convoy, and we had them point their 240 Bravos at us. Like, they don't know who the heck we are. Granted, we're in suburban, so probably giving us the benefit of the doubt. I've talked to so many military members that said, oh, yeah, I remember you Blackwater guys. We ended up shooting at you. And I thought, well, you guys need to go to the range because you guys missed a lot because I never even heard it. The Iraqi people did not see us as military. And this is secondhand, but I had a buddy in Ramadi that essentially said the Blackwater guys were seen as like the terrorists against the locals because we did not have the same rules. We moved people off the road all the time. We didn't have the same rules of engagement. So the local population definitely understood that there was a difference, probably not what that difference was, but they sure as heck didn't like us, I can tell you that.
Gotcha. And was Uday and Kusei, were they found already, or was that after that? Was that before you got there?
That was, yeah, they got killed, I think, before Saddam got captured. I could be wrong on that, but yeah, so that was before me. I got there in August 2004. So you had the Blackwater guys hanged off the bridge in March 2004.
Right.
And then that caused, this is kind of interesting because that civilians in combat roles caused the U.S. to send the Marines into Fallujah in like April 2004. Then they stopped. They tried to do a ceasefire and all that. Didn't work out. They sent the Marines in again in October 2004 when I was there. And they diverted all the air assets to help with Fallujah. So that's a direct example of how having civilians in a combat zone affects war policy, because there were Marines that got, you know, injured, they got killed taking Fallujah. Maybe they would have taken it, maybe they hadn't. But the catalyst was that incident on the bridge in 2004.
Gotcha. And did you kind of, I mean, your book is also not just about doing your job. You guys got paid better than the regular military, but you guys also, the R&R was different in your time down. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so we definitely got paid more. So I came in at $550 a day. When I was over there as an E4 during the ground offensive, I don't know what I was making, but I can tell you it wasn't $200,000 a year. It was probably closer to 60 with all my benefits and stuff. And we would do a 6-month contract. In contrast, the military usually did a 12-month contract if you were, or not contract, a 12-month deployment if you were Army, and then it just depended on the branch of service. But when we had R&R, we could essentially go anywhere we wanted. We could go home, we could go to Amsterdam, we could go to the Philippines. It didn't matter as long as we came back if we had another contract. So the day we left country, essentially, they weren't tracking anything that we did. And what happened was, this is kind of the girls part of the book cover, is a lot of the contractors would go to like Amsterdam and the Philippines and buy hookers and come back and tell these just amazing stories about hookers. And when I say amazing, I mean terrible. Like, no good story ever came out of buying a hooker that I ever heard. But yeah, we just did whatever we wanted. And then we came back, and even in Iraq, we could drink. We didn't have somebody saying you have to stay on this base. Nobody was watching if we, you know, went somewhere. We had an incident where some of the Blackwater guys left the green zone to go watch the Kid Rock concert over at, Camp Liberty, which is right at the airport, most bombed route in Iraq. And nobody paid attention to us. We didn't have the rules. We didn't have the bureaucracy of the military, which is good because we could get stuff done and we didn't have to stand around for 3 to 4 hours like you do in the military. But at the same time, without any adult supervision, you know, kids are going to be kids and contractors are going to be contractors.
Right. And how do you think that the administration of Blackwater and how they controlled all the contractors or mercenaries was different than the American military?
Well, I mean, first off, we could be hired and fired on demand. Now, it's very convenient for politicians to hire private military contractors. And that started in 2004 with Iraq. It's still happening today. There's the route from Gaza to Egypt that just got a private military, U.S. private military contractor is going to be taking that. We have contractors in the Ukraine, at the U.S.-Mexico border, in Syria, in Israel, you name it. And what it allows is politicians to kind of take an arm's length or two arm's lengths away from actually having to put their name on these individuals that are serving this purpose. So I'll give you an example. As a contractor, one of the guys was taking a pee on a wall, and a State Department guy walked over and said, "Hey, I want that guy fired." And they fired him on the spot. At the same time, if something bad happened, it allowed the State Department to say, "Oh, that wasn't us. Those were the bad eggs, right? Oh, you know, oh, I'm sorry. Those were the contractors." So that's why I think when everybody assumed contracting died after Afghanistan and Iraq ended, it's only gotten bigger because it's so politically advantageous to be able to say, "That wasn't me, that was the contractor," and then just fire them. And then, you know, nobody tracks this stuff. I got fired multiple times. I got fired the first time in like July 2005, went straight to a different contract up in Kirkuk and finished out my contract up there.
Wow, interesting. So it's almost like they watch it. And you were around people that the American public would know, right? Escorting them, driving them around. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the ambassador to Iraq was John Negroponte. And then Khalilzad took over for him. I think that was his name. And then we would have senators come in. We'd drive them around the green zone, do a dog and pony show. They never got anywhere close to harm's way, but they felt like they were really, you know, in the shit.
They got some good photo ops, I bet, huh?
Yeah, or you have like the reporters that would come in for the elections. So we'd drive around to an election spot. The reporters would talk to some diplomat talking about how democracy was flourishing in Iraq, which is horse crap. But then, you know, all the locals were sitting there with their blue finger, their purple fingers showing that
they had voted. Was huge in the American media. It's all the blue finger pictures and all that stuff. That was the narrative, bringing democracy to Iraq.
Yeah, and it was all crap, right? Like, that's part of the reason I wrote the book. All the news channels were saying we're making great progress. And as you listen to the book, you just hear me sit there and say, "Oh my God, this war, there's no way we're going to win this war. If this guy's in charge and that guy's in charge and nobody's coordinating anything, are we ever going to, one, know what winning is?" I don't think that was ever defined. And two, like, the people that are doing it for 11 months at a time and then rotating out, and then new people come in and try to get their promotion out of it. Like, it was just ridiculous.
Wow. So the whole notion of Iraq becoming a functioning democracy, you think is not true? I mean, can you kind of tell the American public why that's the case?
Yeah. So first off, it was never going to happen. Saddam Hussein was a Sunni. All right, let me back up. So within the Islamic religion, there are Sunnis and there are Shias, and their division goes all the way back to when Muhammad was dying. And I won't get into why, but they don't like each other. Saddam Hussein was the minority. He was a Sunni. He ruled Iraq, which is majority Shia, and he ruled those guys with an iron fist. And he was terrible, absolutely terrible. The only good thing he did is he kept Iran and Saudi Arabia in check. But for his people, he was just he was an asshole. Let's be honest here. So when we took out Saddam Hussein and we got rid of the entire Ba'ath Party, so we took all the Sunnis that knew how to run a government and had run the government for 30, 40 years, we then put in a Shia government. And the Shia government said, "Oh, we're going to make democracy." But all the Shias on the ground were like, "Look, these guys have been literally like raping and killing us for 30, 40 years. We want retribution." So in 04, 05, that's when you started hearing about the Shia kill squads going around Baghdad. You had neighborhoods that were expelling the Sunnis, so they were only Shia neighborhoods. These things didn't happen under Saddam. It wouldn't have mattered what we did. Those two warring factions were going to go to war, whether we were there or not. What we did do is we prolonged them going to war for, you know, over a decade. And then as soon as we left, nobody gave a crap. So there was no news about, you know, what's happening between the Sunnis and the Shias. And who knows how stable they are right now.
Right. Officially, we left Iraq in 2011, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Is that right? Right. So what do you think, like the U.S., this was a huge kind of financial boon, I guess, for the military industrial complex in Iraq. Can you kind of talk about the money was spent, maybe misspent while you were there, or things that you saw?
Yeah, the only people not making money were the soldiers on the ground. Let's be honest here. Contractors were making money. KBR came in there. They had all the contracts to cook food and, you know, sweep the grounds and stuff. And they'd hire locals to do this. The soldiers on the ground were the only ones that were getting paid meagerly. And I say that from like a corporate standpoint. And what we've done is we have turned what are normally like durable goods, right? So think of that KitchenAid that your grandma had for 50 years and she passed it down. That's what bombs and grenades and bullets used to be. You could keep those for 10, 15 years and they would still be fine. Now the military industrial complex is so used to consuming those goods with Afghanistan and Iraq that we can't produce them fast enough and get them overseas fast enough to be spent. That's why we have $60 billion going to Ukraine, $21 billion going to Israel. Like, it doesn't matter what war it is. War is profitable, and the people in that military-industrial complex are lobbying every day for more weapons going overseas, more people, more private security to train these people and apparently protect Gates in Gaza so that they can pad their bottom line.
Right. I mean, it's just an extraordinary amount of money that was spent in Iraq in general, not just on Blackwater mercenaries or anything. It's just trillions and trillions of dollars went in there. Can you kind of talk about maybe some of the violence and the threats? I know you talk about some kids that were injured and things like that, and maybe expand upon the consequences of the war for Americans and you and the Iraqi people.
Yeah, so I think it was like the third day I was in Iraq. We were getting rocketed. Now, look, rockets and mortars in the green zone was kind of like having a rooster in your backyard. It was your wake-up call. So you'd wake up, you'd hear a rocket or a mortar hit. Not a big deal if it wasn't that close. I'd say on day three, we had a rocket hit, and it was pretty close. And then we had a second one hit like right after, and it was really close. And we were like, holy fray, holy, that was close. But nobody wanted to be the guy that ran out of the tent. You know, we didn't want to be the wimp. So the third one hit, and it was so close that it like kind of it compresses your guts. It's hard to explain. Everybody was sitting up in their bed. They looked around. One guy ran out of the tent, and we were like, thank God he took off. And we took off after him. But we weren't the wimps, right? It was this guy, which kind of made us all feel better as we were smoking cigarettes in the bunker. But what we did do with Blackwater is we controlled the roads. And the military did this also, but we definitely controlled the roads. When you have somebody that's supposedly that important in one of your vehicles, you clear the roads out. You try to get from point A to point B as fast as you possibly can. I can't tell you how many vehicles we smashed into. We caused accidents. We pushed vehicles into light poles, into barriers. We ran roughshod over Baghdad. So in one sense, we're sitting there protecting the people that are helping them build this new country. And then on the other hand, we're pissing off everybody in this country to try to help build it. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. To what you were talking about earlier is there was an incident where this vehicle was driving northbound while we were driving southbound coming from Suleimaniyah to Kirkuk. And it was driving probably 110 miles an hour, nice BMW. And it lost control and it started flipping. This is something that I had only seen in movies. Like, this could have been in the Avengers movie. It was flipping so violently. I thought, holy crap, like, this can't be real. So I stop the vehicle and I pop out, and right there in front of me is like a little kid that had been ejected out of the vehicle, and his eyes are staring up at the sky, and they're blue. They're light blue, which is like a very Kurdish thing, with dark hair. And he's got like brain fluid coming out of his nose, that really clear brain fluid. So we were able to save one kid. We tried to save him. I don't know if it, you know, if he ever made it out or not. Two of the people in the vehicle died. He must have had eight people in that thing. So we bandaged him up. We got him to the hospital. And if we were in the military, they would have lined us all up. They would have put these nice big medals on our chest and said, you did good. Because we're contractors, I don't think anybody even knew we did it, right? There was no report on it. There's no like, hey, you guys did good. It was just like, all right, we did that. We did what we needed to. Back to your mission. It's a very weird place to be.
And how long were you in or stationed in Iraq?
Oh, geez, I should have bought a condo there. I was there in 03 during the ground offensive. And then I was there in 04, 05 for Blackwater for 18 months. And then I went back in 2009, 2010 for another year. So, you know, I was pushing 3 years there.
Wow. 3 years over time, over what? Seven or 8 years.
Yeah.
That's really something else. So you've seen it change. Like, what do you think the long-term kind of historical effects of the American invasion are, other than letting loose this kind of sunny Shia, you know, mutual recrimination? I mean, what's your kind of take now looking back from 2024?
We are going to look back at the invasion of Iraq, if we aren't already, and say that is what destabilized the Middle East more than anything else that ever happened. Say what you want about Saddam Hussein. The guy was an abject, like, dick. But he kept Iraq in check. And Iraq is literally the fault line between the Sunnis in Iran. The Shias in Iran and the Sunnis over in Saudi Arabia. So now that you have a Shia-run government, you're seeing that the Kurds are starting to fight up in Turkey. They have been for years, but now they're starting to fight for their own autonomy in Turkey. The Iranians were able to use the Iraqi airspace to bomb Israel. The Saudi Arabians are essentially saying, you can't use any of our land if you're going to assist the Israelis. I mean, we really created this free-for-all where everybody is going to probably for the next 30, 40 years try to be the kingpin of the Middle East. So huge mistake in hindsight.
So it's kind of making a power vacuum where everybody else is kind of striving in different ways, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a power vacuum, but the lines are already pretty well drawn until we took out Iraq. And that's where now you have this line where the Sunnis and the Shias and the Kurds are all going to try to figure out how to stay autonomous from each other, right? So if you look at Russia and the Ukraine, Russia is saying, I'm going into Ukraine to keep off NATO. I wouldn't be shocked to have Iran say, hey, I'm going to go into Iraq to make sure that the Sunnis aligned with Saudi Arabia don't gain ground. Or Saudi Arabia, you know, by proxy, having their Sunnis move across into Iraq because you have pretty much all your natural resources and your oil are not Sunni controlled. I just don't see it going well.
It's not going well now. I can tell you that in 2024, things aren't looking that great. You could get reemployed, I guess. Do you still keep in touch with your fellow mercenaries, or did you feel like it was kind of a bonding experience, or you kind of showed up and earned your salary and left?
So I do keep in touch with a few of them, like a handful. When the book came out, a lot of them came out against it, which I was kind of surprised. Like, I'm telling the ground story instead of, you know, saying it's great or bad. Like, I'm trying to just tell our story. And they were mad. I mean, they're still mad because they don't want to be called mercenaries. I see where their argument is. And my argument is, I could have went back over there as an E4 and made $50,000 a year. But I chose to raise my hand and take the $550 a day. So they're pissed off at that. They're pissed off that, oh, that didn't happen this way. And it's interesting because anybody can write a book if I can. Nobody wants to write a book. They just want to bitch about what other people write in their books is what it feels like. So the ones that read it that actually worked with me are like, you nailed it. The ones that didn't work with me, didn't know me, were like, oh, this guy wasn't even real Blackwater. And it's like, well, I got the pay stubs. Leave me alone.
Did you have any kind of blowback from Blackwater or whatever it is now? I don't even know what they're called. They've kind of been through a few corporate iterations. I think it's Constellus Holdings now or something.
Yeah.
But so did you sign any like NDA or anything like that to work for them?
No, I did not sign an NDA, but that didn't stop the Blackwater guys from threatening to sue me. One of them said he was going to make my family homeless. Just real class acts. So Blackwater changed its name to Z and then to Academy and then got bought out by Triple Canopy and then got bought out by Constellus. Blackwater doesn't exist. It just doesn't. The only thing they do is they have a licensing agreement where they have their little bear paw logo and they put that on guns and ammunition and all these other things that people make, but it's a licensing play. They don't exist except for, you know, getting paid for every bullet that gets manufactured with their name on it. So that did not stop them from threatening that I had signed an NDA, that I had like all these stupid things. But if there's one thing I can say about Black, two things. One, Eric Prince was a genius when he got into this contracting stuff. And two, they did not keep records very well. So if they dig through the records that they have given over to eight different companies to find something that I signed and they want to present that in court, I'll still probably win because Blackwater's got the worst reputation ever.
Right. I mean, you say that Eric Prince is a genius. Why do you say that? Just because it was a good lucrative career, or why do you believe that?
Eric Prince isn't dumb. Eric Prince looked at the military and said, for every soldier we have over there, it's costing us $250,000. Because you have to pay for them. You have to pay for their food. You have to pay for their housing over there. You have to pay for their health care for them, for their family, their housing back home. You have to pay for all these things. And as a contractor, you can go over there for $200,000. It's more cost effective. And you don't really have to supply any of that stuff because it's being supplied by the military that's already there. It's a sunk cost. So it's genius in that he looked at it from a financial perspective and said, we can do it cheaper and better. Whereas the military can't. And the military, in many ways, with the bureaucracy, can't get out of its own way either. Blackwater was built to be, you know, lean and mean. So the downfall of that is that with Blackwater, we didn't have any support. So if something happened, we couldn't just call a big army and say, hey, come help us, because we didn't coordinate with them. We didn't have them, you know, we didn't have them on a radio frequency. If we did long range missions, we wouldn't have radio communications with anybody for a long time. And if something happened, it was just us. So he's genius because he's right. It was cheaper to do, but at the same time, you're putting these civilians in harm's way for months and years at a time. They come back with PTSD, anger issues, all that stuff. And there's no VA to support them, right? Yeah, it's cheaper because you don't have to support them while they're in the military and after they get out through the VA and all these things that happen with war. And Eric Prince is not raising his hand to say, hey, let's set up a VA for contractors, because that's expensive.
Right. Right. You show up, do the work. How many Blackwater mercenaries do you think filtered through Iraq total in the time of the Iraq war? How many were on the ground at any given time?
On the ground, you're probably looking at 800. On like at any given moment, I think that's a little high. The ones that filtered through, you're probably looking at 2,500. But, I mean, you remember Blackwater got kicked out of Iraq in 2007. So it's really only 3 years of people that worked under Blackwater. After that, they could work Triple Canopy or DynCorp or anybody else that won that contract. But Blackwater itself was only like a 3.5-year thing.
Right. Not that long and not that big compared to how many people were on the ground in the American military. Not huge, but you guys got a lot of media. And do you have time for a few questions? Because Stephen Weissop asked, what do you think of the lies from the media when you came back home? I mean, what was your perception of what happened on the ground as to what was being told in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, so two things. One, when I came back and I worked for Blackwater, everybody was like, holy crap, he's one of those guys, which I'm not. I'm not that cool. I just kind of lucked into it and was able to prove myself. But at the same time, coming back and having people ask me, like from a strategic standpoint, what's going to happen in Iraq and what's going on with this? And I would say it's a lost cause. Like, we should just pull out of there. We should just bomb the whole thing and turn it into glass, because there was no way we were ever going to win that war. So it was very frustrating to come back. And then Mr. Square happened in 2007. You can't really put Blackwater on your resume at that point. Nobody's going to hire you. I couldn't go get a police officer job. So it was frustrating.
So kind of a frustrating end. It wasn't, yeah, interesting. Do you find any comparisons between Iraq and our experience in Vietnam?
Yes, in that we don't have a goal. We didn't have a goal. We didn't have any kind of way to say this is what winning looks like. And then we did it for a year at a time. This time we did it for units for a year. In Vietnam, we did it by person for a year. I think what the closer parallel to Vietnam is going to be Ukraine, because instead of us sending advisors, let me step back. In Vietnam, we started with advisors. They started with like the CIA and military advisors. And then we slowly got pulled into that war. Instead of that, we're doing the CIA advisors and private military contract advisors, and we're putting them into Gaza. We're putting them into Ukraine. We're putting them into Syria. And we're slowly creeping into that war footing without putting boots on the ground. But if something happens to those civilians, it's going to cause our foreign policy decisions to shift. And that would be my fear, is those places less than Iraq.
Interesting. Well, it's a really interesting book. There's a lot more in this book than people know. Like, for this is a first person experience too. It's much different than a kind of a detached book somebody writes in the U.S. Like, you literally experience it. Where's the best place for a listener to get Guns, Girls, and Greed?
Amazon is definitely the best place. So like you mentioned, we got the hardcover, Kindle, Jay Moore. He was in Jerry Maguire at Saturday Night Live. So you can pick it up through Amazon. And for my social media, if you guys have any questions, if you are a PMC, please reach out. There's something called the Defense Base Act, where there was an insurance policy that was taken out on the private military contractors that nobody knew about. And now those are starting to pay out, but it's all word of mouth. So reach out to me. I'm on X. I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok, if you like that. And it's all Blackwater Dude One. So Blackwater Dude and the number one. Track me down. Happy to help you guys out.
Blackwater Dude One is the way to find him on X, Instagram, TikTok. And thanks so much for your time. Great talk, great book. Congratulations, great reviews. And I really enjoyed the audiobook. I don't listen to audiobooks that often. And the full title of the book is Guns, Girls, and Greed. I Was a Blackwater Mercenary in Iraq. And the author is Morgan Lerette, Lerette, just published February 2024. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, William. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I do too. Stay there.